Welcome to Lucy's Record Shop. I'm your host, Mary Mancini. Every weekend and several times during the week, Don Kendall and I booked out-of-town bands to play at Lucy's. And we had them play sandwiched in between a couple of locals. That was Donnie thinking strategically that it would be the time when the most people would be at the club. We wanted the out-of-town bands to have an audience and to feel welcome. Burt, a noise rock band from Montgomery, Alabama, was one of those bands. Burt played tons of shows throughout the South and Southeastern United States between 1992 and 1998. And since there were no cell phones or social media at the time, bands like Burt, who were doing everything themselves, making the music, putting out their own records, booking their own shows or tours, found out about places like Lucy's by either word of mouth or by reading the most famous punk rock zine at the time, Maximum Rock and Roll. Maximum Rock and Roll started in 1977 as a punk radio show on KPFA in Berkeley, California. A Vice magazine article from 2019 described the show as, quote, one of the first and best of all time, with Tim Yohannan, Jeff Bale, Ruth Schwartz, and Jello Biafra playing the latest punk and hardcore sounds from across the world, the U.S., and from their home in the bristling San Francisco Bay Area punk scene. The radio show as a zine first appeared in 1982. It was a newsprint booklet inserted into the double LP, Not So Quiet on the Western Front, which was a compilation of about 50 bands from Northern California and Nevada, released on the Alternative Tentacles label. By issue number 5, MRR was covering punk bands and scenes from around the world in a self-described effort to, quote, keep the worldwide punk community connected. In 1989, Kamala Parks, who was an MRR contributor and the co-founder of Berkeley's legendary all-ages punk club 924 Gilman Street, had the bright idea to write a how-to column, which was basically her sharing what she did when she booked tours for Bay Area bands like Operation Ivy and Neurosis. She called the article Book Your Own Fucking Tour, and it was such a success that MRR made it a monthly feature that listed the addresses and phone numbers of punk clubs and bookers around the world. And because it was such an important part of the DIY culture, specifying whether a club was all ages or not. If you wanted to be listed in Book Your Own Fucking Life as a show booker or a band, you would send in a postcard or letter with your info. Bands could also send in reviews of bookers and venues, basically the pre-digital version of a thumbs up or a thumbs down. By 1992, the same year that Lucy's Record Shop opened its doors and Burt started touring, the monthly Book Your Own Fucking Tour section of Maximum Rock and Roll morphed into a totally separate publication, and it was by then more than just a listing of bookers and venues. They called it Book Your Own Fucking Life, and it included up-to-date phone numbers and addresses of bands, labels, and venues, but also radio stations, distributors, record and bookstores, and zines, and they were all listed by geographic region. The first issue was 65 pages long. The introduction in that first issue said this: over these past years, the DIY movement has grown at an unprecedented rate, in some cases fueled by profit-making trends, but for the most part on a real grassroots level. The national and international communication within the DIY movement is what has kept it strong over the years. Through the efforts of certain individuals and fanzines, people have been able to make concrete connections between people of similar interests and have created an entire underground economy based on the spreading of our own living culture and ideals. Bands have been able to promote themselves, book tours, put out records, without bowing down to the corporate music industry. That's the essence of DIY. People helping other people without an eye for profit, only for creating a better world and having some fun. Networking has played a major role in making all this happen. That's why we present Book Your Own Fucking Life. We hope this magazine will help us make a giant step forward towards international solidarity for DIY people and organizations. This is the first attempt at such an interactive listing in recent years, where people have been given equal and free opportunity to take part. Bands like BERT embraced the DIY culture wholeheartedly. They booked their own shows, they toured constantly, they self-released two cassettes and two split 7-inches before Nashville's House of Pain put out their 7-inch called Ambient Doug, and also before they recorded with Steve Albini for their two releases that were released on Chicken Ranch Records. For BERT, Book Your Own Fucking Life was indispensable. For the low, low price of $1, they had all they needed to book as many gigs as they wanted to play. So they got on the phone, the landline, and started calling. Donnie and Lucy's, only a five-hour rickety van ride from Montgomery, was on the other end of one of those calls. I sat down with BERT, guitar player and vocalist Jeff McLeod, drummer Glenn Grant, and original bass player Mark Coleman to talk about one of their absolute favorite places to play, Lucy's Record Shop. How did BERT get together?
Man, Glenn, I was thinking, you know, before I knew we were doing this, how we met. And I think I met you through your band, Flip Your Wig, when I was filling in for that guitar player at a gig that never happened. Is that right? That's how we really got to know each other.
Yeah. And then the guy you were filling in for, luckily, he came back because you got your first kidney stones then. You were filling in for somebody and then you got sick. I don't know what we were really shooting for.
I do. I remember.
Was it when I was obsessed with Daisy Chainsaw?
Swerve Drive.
We definitely didn't get the whole shoegaze thing right.
Yeah, we started out as that, me and him, and tried out a lot of bass players. And at that time, we were trying to do this Swerve Driver kind of thing. But once we added Larry and Mark, because I was already playing with Mark in this noise improv metal band, we wore like masks and jumpsuits, kind of Mr. Bungle-ish type. Look, but musically pretty nightmarish, called Mondale Smell Feast. So it was easy bringing Mark in because we were already doing some, you know, weird shit, and he fit right in. And then Larry came in, you know, it all just kind of happened. And it ended up sounding nothing like Swerve Drive. Larry did very theatrical things early on in the band. He would wear like a butcher's apron with blood all over it, or a skirt, and he would mimic using the bathroom in a pie plate. Again, nothing like Swerve Driver. Larry had to quit. He was also involved in acting at our Shakespeare Festival here, wasn't it? Shakespeare? Anyway, he was pretty convinced, and people were telling him, you're ruining your voice screaming in that noise band. And it was true. So we kind of understood. We had a lot of gigs booked. And so I had to sing. That's how that happened. I just had to start doing it. I didn't know what I was doing.
So pooping in a pie plate to Hamlet. Got it.
Yeah. It's not a big stretch. Not too big.
How would you describe your music?
It's just noise rock, kind of punky noise rock, weird guitar tunings and screaming, yelling, abstract lyrics.
So I think most of the descriptions we got in like Maximum Rock and Roll and stuff like that were touch and go-ish, like Chicago sound, I guess.
Ginsu knives in a clothes dryer.
How did you decide to go on the road?
I think at the time there were, you know, there were a lot of shows and house shows here in town, and we played a lot here, and just through Maximum Rock and Roll and their booking magazine, Book Your Own Fucking Life, we were like, we could do this, and all these other places have the same type stuff going on. You know, why don't we go play there? Nashville's close. And that's how I met Don. We did some shows later with Fun Girls here in town, at least two. But it was through Book Your Own Fucking Life. I think Donnie had a listing in there, and it was the first show was one of the Migraine Matinees. I don't know if Nashville was one of our, that was certainly one of our first far away shows. And I don't think we even had another show for that first Nashville show. I think we just drove up and played at Lucy's and stayed with Dallas Thomas, maybe. But that was the beginning of that. And I don't know how many times subsequently we played there. Donnie and I have been trying to remember that too. I know at least three, but he says more.
There were a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Oh, whoa.
10 from 1993, August 29th of 1993 was the first one. And then July 19th, 1997 was the last. And what was your first thought when you got there?
I remember that this was like one of our earliest shows out of town this far. And so it's like we invited everybody in the world to come with us. And so I've got some specific memories of that. First, I was always, whenever I went to a quote unquote real city from Montgomery, I always wanted to go to a record store and see what they had, because we had Camelot music in the mall and that was about it. So we're there and it's huge and it has everything I could, just things I'd never heard of and I wanted to explore. And then I see the big room in the back and it's ginormous and there's lots of people. It was a real exciting time.
And so here's a list of shows that let's sort of go through each one and tell me what you remember. But the first one was August 29th of 1993. Bert played with Fred, F-R-E-D, from Orlando, Florida, and Finger Hut.
That's Dallas, yeah.
Yeah. Great. So that means we definitely stayed with Dallas that night.
Yeah.
In the suburbs.
And how did you first connect with Dallas? Was that at that show or before?
It was there. Yeah, we were immediate friends, and there were many shows we played with some band that Dallas was in. Maybe Brown Cow maybe was one of those shows. But we would go from the show and stay at Dallas's dad's house, and we would take all our gear into Dallas's basement, and us and Dallas would jam all night, even after the show.
They seemed like they were all 12 at the time.
Close.
They probably were. Yeah,
very close.
Okay, next show, March 19th, 1994, Horace Pinker, Bert, and Cannibal Holiday.
That show, or either the one before, was where we met people that I still have relationships with, Christopher Scott Davis, Dylan Hawes Glenn, and Jeremy Trotter, who played in the Most Amazing Century of Science band and many other bands. But that's where we met them. One of their parents would drop them off there, 14, 15 years old.
The next one, same year, August, few months later, August 5th, 1994, Impetuous Doom, Bert, and Uncle Daddy.
I remember Impetuous Doom were super metal.
Who would have guessed that from the name?
Impetuous Doom.
I can see it written where nobody could read it.
Okay, so the next year, January 14th, 1995, Finger Hut, Bert, and Fecal Matter.
I think that was the one where the guy who was singing for Finger Hut started witnessing from stage, and we were thinking he was joking, so we were bantering back, and we didn't understand, because we hadn't been across Christian punk bands that much yet, and we had no clue that he is not being joking. He is not being ironic. He is witnessing about Jesus Christ from the stage. Okay, this is new.
He didn't count on getting heckled.
Well, you had a show almost a year later, December 15th, 1995, same year. It was Fecal Matter again, and Bert, and Bliss.
We like that Fecal Matter.
Yeah. Also, greatest name ever.
Yeah.
April 13th. Okay, so then let's move on to 1996. It was April 13th, Cab Over Pete, Bert, and Cheap Shots.
Yeah, I remember when I also remember some of those first few shows, we would always have our tapes and stuff back there, and we had some 7 inches and splits and stuff. And in the early 90s, we had people didn't really know what the 7-inch record was. So weird. They were like, is that a CD? And it's like, no, it's a record. It's so weird.
August 9th, 1996. So this year you played three times. August 9th, 1996. Situation No Win, Bert and Dead Cat.
We were some gigging motherfuckers.
We were. We really were.
Yeah, December 14th, 1996. High Strung, Bert, and Cab Over Pete again.
I do know all our shows, we always sold all our stuff, all the tapes, all the records we brought. It was always so much support every show. I can't think of a show where that was bad.
So that was December 14th, 1996. Skip over to April 26th, 1997. Now, this one's a little interesting because I had two versions of the same calendar. It was Of His Own Hand, Bert, and Booby Hatch. But on one version of the calendar, it's crossed out. Your name is crossed out. Like either you didn't show up or it was... Not that you didn't show up. That sounds terrible. I don't mean it like they didn't show up. Or something happened. But do you remember anything about that show?
I remember playing with Booby Hatch because wasn't Booby Hatch another Dallas Thomas?
And Donnie, yeah.
And they also had tapes they put out for Little Monkey on a Stick right about the same time. I remember that stuff. Crazy stuff. Yeah. I remember playing with them. I don't know if that's the only time, but.
And then the last one is the July 19th, 1997 show, Today is the Day, Governing Fire, and you guys.
Did By All Means play at that show, too? Because I have their 7-inch, and I remember we played with them at Lucy's once, and maybe at another show from another calendar. They were a band from somewhere in Virginia that were on tour at the same time as well, and I remember trading records with them. I don't know. I think we were added on. Because we were nearby or something for a show like you were talking about. I've seen remember Donnie asking us, hey, can you do this? And we just kind of did. I just want to say how awesome being able to have played 10 times. I can't believe it.
Yeah, that's nuts.
At Lucy's was. And I think the friendships and the people that I'm still friends with, shout out to Chris, Jeremy, and Dylan, Dallas. I talk to them all the time still. It's one of the greatest things of my life.
All right. I feel the same way.
Lucy's was a 5-hour drive for us. And, you know, that's enough of a drive to make all of us grumpy. But going to Lucy's was never in question. It's, of course, we're going to go to Lucy's and have an amazing show because that's what happens there.
So what makes an amazing show for a band like Bert?
I think enthusiasm from people who are there to see something they haven't seen or heard. And they come up to you during and after and before sometimes with just sheer excitement. It's like we're like, you know, we agree. We're just into the same thing. I think meeting so many people that roll the same way.
When we would play, I used to have a joke about when we would play that we would start with 150 people in the audience, and three songs later, which is only 5 minutes for us, there would be like 8 people in the audience, but they would all be thinking we were fucking God. That was our normal show. And so when we went to Lucy's, and not only is it packed out, but everybody stays, everybody's into it, everybody's excited, everybody's moving. that's a great show. Not the we had a song on an early recording called Yet Another Night of Beer Drinkers and Pool Shooters. That was, you know, that was indifference is what, unless you knew you were going into a show with the crowd that knew what they were in for, they're here for the metal band after us, and we are decidedly not metal. We are not Pearl Jam. They are not what we were not what was expected to see. So going there and there be that enthusiasm from the very beginning when we were an unknown quantity was just sort of amazing.
What is the weirdest thing that happened to Bert on the road?
Just some of the horrific places we've stayed. Oh. I mean,
that place in Pensacola with the whatever that band's name was.
Deadwood.
No windows.
Deadwood.
No windows. It was like 7 degrees outside. No windows in the room that we were sleeping in. I was just glad it was cold because that probably killed the roaches. The dog used the closet in that room for a bathroom. Was that the place you stood on the drum head to shower?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They were like, we've got a shower. Your drummer looks pretty sweaty. So that morning, I couldn't get the shower curtain to pull back on the tub. And when I finally got it, it looked like brown fudge in the bottom of this tub. So I thought, well, maybe this will wash out. So I turned the hot water on. There was no hot water, and the fudge wasn't going anywhere. It was just propelling the water. So I went and got a spare drum head out of the van and tried to stand on it. But once it got wet, it slid all around. It was horrible. Horrible. But yeah, there's lots of stories like that. It's typical any band on the road that doesn't make any money and it's lucky enough to have somebody say, oh, you can stay at our place. You just kind of deal with it.
The filth.
As an adult, I don't think I could deal with it. But then, yeah, it was just part of it, I guess.
How many floor? I mean, I can sleep on the floor occasionally, but we just slept on the floor. And got up the next day and started moving again and all in.
Think of sleeping on the stage at Culture Shock in Mobile. And we had never seen that place in the daytime. And when we woke up with sleeping bags on the stage, I was mortified. I thought, my goodness, this is the grossest place I've ever been in. And that guy came running out and said, hey, we've got a shower in the back. And I was like, nah, I'll skip it. I don't even want to see it.
You're not going to fall for that again.
Yeah, no, I've learned my lesson.
I am glad to have the experience of weekend warrioring a band for the better part of a decade. Because, you know, that some people went to boot camp and we just slept in nasty floors and played for 14 people for $25. Texas,
and paid in change.
Yeah,
in a Crown Royal bag. Yeah,
paid in pornography.
Written or like at least VHS tapes. What did they give you?
'80s VHS. I'm so glad to have had those experiences. So you know, we may joke about sleeping in the dog crap room, but now it's a fond. Oh, all right. Fond is the wrong word. Now it's a memory.
And cell phones too. The few shows I've gone to in the past few years, it's like nobody's really paying attention. They're staring at their phone. But at the same time, I wish people had had that technology then. Then there would be more footage of what we did. There's some little video footage of any of our shows. I wish there had been more of that.
I have a friend who is he's been on ARBCOM and all sorts of positions of authority with Wikipedia. And we get into conversations all the time that from like the early 90s to the late 90s, there's sort of a gap online of stuff because the earlier stuff it's got this cachet to it. When things started, everybody started going online, it had this retro kish to it. But The 90s stuff, just a lot of it disappeared, especially indie stuff. It fell into the crevice where it didn't get archived. It didn't get uploaded. It didn't find its way online. And I think that's a big hole that it's going to take people our age digging through stuff and digitizing it before it does go online.
You had mentioned that you Jeff, that you drove up to see shows at Lucy's.
I do, yeah. Craw came up to see. I don't remember who else played because all I cared about was seeing this band from Cleveland, Craw, who are amazing. And I think it was a very small crowd, not a nighttime show, not a matinee. But the crowd just consisted of people like us. It was me and my friend Kenny Johnson. We drove up in my now wife Vonda's car. And I remember it was freezing cold. It was early in the year. And the only people in there were other people who'd driven for 4 and 5 hours to see this band. You know, we were obsessed with this band, Craw. And it was so cold when we left her little Nissan or whatever we were in, the doors were frozen shut. Remember, we had to come back in and get something from you to help get our prior doors open.
How did it come about that Donnie put out a 7-inch on House of Pain?
It's kind of a timing thing. He asked us if we wanted to do one after we'd played there several times. And we were like, yeah. And it just turned out that we had a multi-track tape of all of our first cassettes, recordings from the studio. And this guy we knew had the 8-track Ampex, I guess, machine that it was recorded on. And we were going to go over there, and that stuff had Larry singing, and we did 4 of the songs super short, and I put 2 vocals on them, and we remixed them and gave them to Donnie. It just turned out, and we're like, hey, we can give you this. We have, you know, this right now.
Took all the reverb out of it.
Took a lot of effects off of it. Oh, man, yeah.
We didn't realize how bad it was until we were doing that. And
yeah, I prefer the original. Mm. Honestly, I don't know about you guys, but I can't listen to it. I sound like shit on there.
Well, you know, you keep asking how this came about, and I'll tell you how this came about. It's because Jeff McLeod can make friends with anybody in a band in like 5 minutes. That is no lie. And he was, I mean, for such a, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, for such an antisocial guy, you make friends with other musicians so quickly. It's amazing.
It's music. Yeah,
exactly. And you listen to so much across so many genres. You've got so many touchstones to talk to other band people about that it's, I imagine if we talked to other places in other cities, he would have similar stories of, and that's where I met these guys that I'm still in contact with. You know, it's sort of amazing to think about how you just made all those contacts and worked at it and kept them up. It was pretty great.
It was that back to book your own fucking life. It was every Wednesday. I would either be my house, Glenn's house, or Mark's house, using the telephone to call to try to book shows out of Book Your Own Fucking Life. One of them was Donnie for Lucy's.
Was it hard to book in other places?
It was a good time. It was easy. There were so many cool people. We played in so many just weird little places that you would think, how they never have a show in there. You know, just through the people you'd meet, freaks posting, hey, I'm booking shows in some little podunk town.
Yeah. A mobile home somewhere in Mississippi.
Have y'all seen Green Room, the horror movie about the punk band on tour?
Yeah.
I watch it and I'm like, oh yeah, that there, but for the grace of God, go I. I mean, that could have been us. A hardcore band sees some skinheads kill some people at a venue in the middle of nowhere, and so the skinheads are actually running the venue, and you can write the rest of it.
Yeah.
Where the skinheads, the Nazis, are the bad guy, which I appreciate in any film.
It's the same director that did the film Blue Ruin.
You guys came from Montgomery, Alabama. The motto of Lucy's was no racist, sexist, or homophobic shit tolerated. Did you have anything like that in Montgomery, or was this kind of the first experience that you had with something like that?
At the time, a lot of places kind of were that way. You know, they kind of wanted to know, well, what are you guys about? You know, can I see your, several people wanted to see lyrics, and there was concern about that. I remember that was cool to see, but here in town, nah.
And it's strange because being in this indie music scene, you would think that almost would be at the default. But I've thought of a couple of things over the recent years. One is, I'm not going to name his name or the band, but we were at a show in, I believe, Decatur or Huntsville. And this guy who played drums for a band from Montgomery just starts dropping the N-bombs and then says it again because I think he liked the way it sounded rolling off his tongue. And we all looked at each other like, what is this? Because they were like, I remember specifically an e-racism, a race racism's bumper sticker. It was like a house party or something like that. You never knew in the South when someone was going to just like launch into that sort of thing. I know we didn't address it enough. I saw a thread Albini did, I think on Twitter or something. I saw it compressed recently talking about, you know, his early work and how a lot of it was transgressive for the sake of being transgressive, which I would never claim we were that, but I know I personally was sometimes transgressive for being the sake of being transgressive. And he talks about using the name Rape Man for a band and how he saw it as the Japanese comic and that he took that sort of this is transgressive, I'm going to take this sort of aggression into the music, but thought it was okay because he was a man who thought about such things and could realize all the issues and the power dynamics and the sexist dynamics and everything like that. But I saw him recently say in this thread that he feels like it's, I think the term was something like soften the language, which made it more acceptable for complete boneheads to feel like they could get away with using that sort of language. I think I would have liked to have seen even more of it just confronting the racists and the sexists and the homophobes around us is sort of the hardest part. And so I love the fact that looking back on it now, 25 years later, that we were going and part of this community, however ancillarily we were there, that encouraged the whole speak up when someone's saying stupid shit. And I wish we would have seen more of it.
More people speaking up, you mean?
Exactly. More people comfortable. Like now, I think I'm a lot more comfortable calling out stupid crap I hear people say face to face. And I don't think I was that confident in myself to confront some things that probably should have been confronted around me. And so I wish we would have seen more places in the Southern indie rock, indie hardcore punk, whatever community, metal community, that would espouse the no racism, no sexism, no homophobia, that would make it such a hard and fast line so that maybe even a greater amount of the community felt more comfortable earlier calling that stuff out.
So you mentioned Steve Albini, Mark, and the way that the band progressed, eventually you ended up in the recording studio with him.
Twice.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
Just because Jeff McLeod can make friends with anybody.
Nice. Long and short of it, a label was going to put out a 10-inch record for us, Homo Habilis Records. It was Jason, who was in Manor Astro Man. Time, his label, and they were like, "You want to record with Steve Albini?" And we were like, "Fuck yeah, we want to record with Steve Albini." So we went to Chicago, and we spent a day recording, and we spent a day mixing six songs for that 10-inch, which never saw the light of day. All the Art Chantry did all the artwork and design.
And won an award. He won an award for the artwork, but that never came out.
It's in his book.
Yeah, it's in his book. It is, yeah. It all was done. It never came out. I don't know the circumstances around it, but it was a real bummer. But then this label out of Austin, Texas, Chicken Ranch Records, Mike Dickinson. Shout out to Mike Dickinson.
Speaking of trailers in the middle of the woods where punk shows go on.
Yeah. He contacted us and said, "Hey, I want to compile all your self-release stuff and that Albini stuff." So we did a CD with them called Quiet Positive Pump. And then the second time he was like, y'all want to record with him again for our second CD. But this time Steve flew down here and recorded in a house in Elmore, Alabama, just this old house of our friend Jim Marr, who had Zero Return Studios there, which eventually moved to Atlanta with Manor Astro Man. And we recorded there with Steve. Same thing. We spent a day recording and a day mixing. And
but it was a full length.
A lot of time blowing up pies on a dirt road with quarter sticks and dynamite.
Bird bombs.
Yeah, bird bombs. Yeah. Steve at the time is a firebug.
And Jim had these little firecrackers meant to scare birds away from fields that were called bird bombs. And so we blew up things with them.
They were like a little bigger than an M80. And we were blowing up pies out in the road.
In between songs?
We got done real quick. We worked well with him because he liked people having their shit together and he wanted to just capture a band live. So all the music's live. There's no overdubs other than the vocals. So we go in there ready and just bang the shit out in a day.
We were a very single take band.
The first take's always the best take. Everybody knows that. We were a good
match. And Albini had a blast. He said it was like going to camp.
You're talking real pies, not like cow patties.
Like real pies. Like there was a little gas station up the road. We would buy Dolly Madison pies, and we were just cutting a hole in them and just blowing them up on the railroad track.
Vaporizing.
Okay, so the band ends. What's the last thing you put out?
We did some things subsequently, like we had a reunion show in, was it 2008? We only agreed, somebody that we had done a split record with, the Ducky Boys, asked us if we'd want to do it. I was like, yeah, if we can just, I don't want to play a bunch of old shit. And we all agreed to we wrote seven new songs and re-recorded an old song. And Chicken Ranch put a little limited release of that. They put out a digital release of that. They put out right before some four track recordings from the practice room on a limited CD and stuff like that. But the last thing we did were those seven new songs, New Fucks, NUFUX. Mm-hmm. And it's free on Chicken Ranch's site. And that's with everybody in the band. Mark was playing bass. Shane, the bass player, came back. Shane Gillis, and he played second guitar, and then Larry Terrell, the singer, came back. So this is the ultimate. It's that stuff's so good. It's really, I don't know if you guys listened to it in a long time, but that stuff is fucking raw.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have any stories, pictures, or music you want to share from the Lucy's days, send them along to @Lucy's Record Shop on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Or you can email me directly at mary@lucysrecordshop.com. Many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio, and to Lamb Chop for the intro music. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at their official site at weownthistown.net or follow @weownthistown on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thanks for listening.